creates most efficient movement of everything, from air to water to traffic to luggage, to lightning to information to ideas, and yes, to attention. Sometimes important ideas simply pop into a person's mind without any warning or preparation. This happens all the time in minor ways. We suddenly remember where we left our glasses, or, out of nowhere, we are taken aback by an insight into a certain relationship we're in, or an investment we're thinking of making. And sometimes, such spontaneous insights change our world. Although rare, the momentous eureka moment does occur. Examples live in the mythology of our culture. Archimedes sitting in his bathtub, discovering displacement, or Newton sitting beneath the famous apple tree, discovering gravity. We don't know for sure if those two moments actually did happen, but they make for great stories. However, I'm going to tell you about one eureka moment that we know for sure did happen recently. We know about it because the man to whom it happened describes it in his 2012 book, Design in Nature. In September 1995, Adrien Bejean, then a 47-year-old professor of mechanical engineering at Duke University, traveled to Nancy, France, to give a lecture at a conference on thermodynamics, his field of specialization. Before he could give his lecture, something took place that we all dream of but rarely experience. It was something Bejean didn't plan or even intimate might occur, something that would change his life, and although it's too soon to tell, it was also something that quite possibly will change our understanding of the world. At the pre-conference banquet, Ilya Prigozhin, the Belgian Nobel laureate, gave a speech Bejean attended. During his talk, Prigozhin made a statement that caught Bejean's attention. Indeed, it stopped him cold. If the apple ever did hit Newton's head, it hit with the same unique impact that Prigozhin's remark hit Bejean. Prigozhin's remark was a commonplace statement, one that the entire scientific community agreed with at the time. He noted that while many tree-like structures in nature, from lightning bolts to the air ducts in lungs to river deltas, resembled each other, they did so purely by chance, and for no reason other than chance. The fact that the structures resembled each other, Prigozhin said, was mere coincidence. No unifying principle dictated either the abundance of such tree-like designs throughout the world, or their congruity in vastly different contexts. As Bejean put it, the moment Prigozhin made that statement, something clicked. The penny dropped. I knew that Prigozhin, and everyone else, was wrong. In a flash, I realized that the world was not formed by random accidents, chance, and fate, but that behind the dizzying diversity is a seamless stream of predictable patterns. He then went on to write out, in longhand and on the spot, what he named the constructal law. For a finite size flow system to persist in time, to live, its configuration must evolve in such a way that provides easier access to the currents that flow through it. At first glance, at least to a non-engineer like me, this principle sounds unimportant and absurdly arcane, not remotely relevant to everyday life, and certainly not relevant to this book. But that first glance would be quite wrong. Let me explain why. The constructal law is a law of physics that governs all flow systems, which is to say, any system, animate or inanimate, in which there is movement of any kind. The constructal law governs every system that we encounter, from traffic, to sports, to the makeup of organizations, to birds in flight, or fish in schools, or, of course, the internet. Which is also to say that it governs not only all those systems, but also the system of neurons in the brain and the flow of ideas those neurons carry. In simple terms, the constructal law states that all flow systems, systems in which there is movement, evolve in such a way as to improve movement against resistance of any kind. Over time, the constructal law predicts that all systems must allow for ever-improving movement. Water through the delta, air through the lungs, lightning from the cloud to the flagpole, or an idea from its inception to its expression. If movement does not proceed more and more efficiently, movement will gradually cease. Perhaps that's one reason so many people stop thinking after they leave childhood. Their minds dam up everything, so that nothing moves forward and develops, but, rather, recirculates. When movement ceases, so does life, which one might define as movement. No movement of any kind is death. In Bejean's language of thermodynamics, death means that the system is at equilibrium with its surroundings. There is no movement in or out of it. This is thermodynamic death, but it might as well mean death, period. Life is movement, or, to use Bejean's word, flow. A tree-like structure is a marvelously effective design for allowing easy flow of water, air, or electricity from an area to a point or a point to an area. That's why nature seeks it and creates it. Now let's look at the brain. What, you might ask, is the design of the connecting junctures between neurons in the brain? The design of a tree, of course. As the long cell body, or trunk, of the nerve cell, or neuron, reaches its end, it splays out into dendrites, or branches, which receive incoming signals from adjacent neurons in the synapse. The very word dendrite is derived from the Greek word for tree. I cite Bejean's movement of discovery to make two points. First, sometimes a great idea, like a great fish, will jerk on your line and all but pull you out of the boat. The great fisherman, like Bejean, is ready for it and so is able to reel it in, even when he least expects it to strike. Second, and far more important for us, Bejean's constructal law tells us that there is a pattern that will improve the flow of ideas. Even if we can't create it at will, just the fact that this pattern exists means we can take steps to increase its likelihood of taking shape. We can take steps to increase the likelihood not only of great ideas finding our bait, but also of attention and thought flowing more efficiently through our conscious minds, even in the absence of a great idea. In 1854, Louis Pasteur famously remarked in a lecture, "Dans les champs de l'observation, l'hasard ne favorise que les esprits préparés." Translation: in the fields of observation, chance favors only the prepared mind. The question then becomes, how best to prepare your mind to allow for the most efficient flow of information and ideas? The anatomy of your brain, made up of millions of dendrites all obeying the constructal law, does what it can. But you can help your brain by taking various steps of your own. There are specific, proven ways you can assist nature and anatomy in allowing for the most efficient flow of ideas. Rather than applying frantic effort in the acute moment, as if you were being reprimanded by a demonic fifth grade teacher, you will achieve flexible focus by relying on planning, preparation, and technique. The most successful ways to sustain attention rely on habit and training, as is the case with just about anything else we want to master. Much of what prevents us from mastering the magic of mental clarity is obstructed or diverted by the incessant input of ideas and information and the kinds of self-sabotaging stories that we tell ourselves. Just as pollution has threatened real fishing, the pollution of our mental lives with excessive and sometimes toxic data, interruptions, memories, interpretations, and distractions threatens our ability to achieve flexible focus. To achieve that goal, we need to both limit the distractions and feed our minds and bodies with what they need. Just as a garden can't thrive without good soil, adequate sunlight, water, and constant weeding of the stuff that chokes out the vegetables and flowers, we can't achieve flexible focus if we don't do the fundamental work of caring for ourselves. Before offering pointers on how to create the conditions that favor flexible focus and remove obstacles to movement of ideas and information through the mind, think to yourself, what could I do to use the constructal law to help me focus more clearly and use my mind more fluently? Or, put another way, since you know your situation better than anyone, ask yourself, what are the obstacles to the free movement of information and ideas through my mind? And how can I remove those obstacles? For most people today, the obstacles could not be more obvious. Ongoing distractions, nonstop interruptions, screen sucking, a multiplicity of opportunities and obligations, and a general overloading of mental circuits. Far from removing obstacles to the free flow of information and ideas through our minds, we often do the opposite. We clog up the channels. We create a mental traffic jam, precisely the opposite of what Bajan's constructal law would have us do. However, it does not have to be that way. The jam can be cleared. Traffic can flow fast and free through the mind, if you make plans for it to do so. Achieve focus three words at a time. 1. Turn it off. T-I-O. Turn off your electronic devices during periods of the day when you want uninterrupted, focused time. 2. Trust your way. Perhaps the single most cliched song lyric ever, "I Did It My Way," became so cliched because its message is so powerful. We focus best and do our best when we do it our way. We all have our routines, our own individualized process or way for producing our best work. Trust yours. When you don't know where you're headed, your process or way will allow your unconscious to enter. It will guide and often surprise you with your most valuable discoveries and unexpected solutions. Don't work against your grain, but with it. 3. Take a break. When you start to glaze over or feel frantic, stop what you are doing. Stand up, walk around, get a glass of water, stretch. Just 60 seconds can do the trick. 4. Do something difficult. People focus most intently when they take on a challenge, when they are working in an area where they are skilled, but where they are also stretched. Often, amazingly enough, what seemed impossible becomes possible. 5. Ask for help. Don't feel it is a sign of weakness to ask for help when you hit a snag. It's just the opposite. A sign of strength that can get you out of a confused place and back on track. 6. Take your time. One of the truest rules of modern life is if you don't take your time, someone or something else will take it from you. Guard your time jealously. It is your most prized possession. Do not give it away easily or let someone regulate it for you, unless you absolutely have to do so. 7. Close your eyes. When you are losing focus or feeling confused, the simple act of sitting back in your chair and closing your eyes can, oddly enough, allow you to see clearly. It can restore focus and provide a new direction. 8. Draw a picture. Visuals clarify thinking. Draw a diagram, construct a table, cover a page with zigzags like a child finger painting. Cover a page with phrases and arrows. Use colored pencils or markers. Draw on poster paper, on an easel, or on the floor. Just get past words and blow up the frame to accommodate visuals of all kinds. You may soon see the bigger picture you'd been looking for coming into focus. 9. Talk to yourself. talking aloud to yourself can lead you out of confusion. Assuming you are in a setting that allows for this, simply talk about the issue you are grappling with. Talking out loud engages a different part of the brain than thinking in silence. It can clear out the fog. 10. Do what works. Don't worry about convention or what's supposed to work. Some people focus better with music playing or in a noisy room. Some people focus better when walking or even running. Some people focus best in early morning, others late at night. Some in cold rooms, others in a sauna. Some while fasting, others while eating. There is no right way, only the best way for you. Experiment and discover what works for you. The essential ingredients: energy, emotion, engagement, structure, control. All the elements in the plan I've developed aim to remove obstacles so that, obeying the constructal law, the mind can connect unimpeded with its targets over extended periods of time. The basic plan provides for the most efficient, least obstructed flow of information and ideas in and out of the brain. The specifics I suggest from here on, from getting physical exercise to creating the optimal emotional state, to reducing distractions, to finding and focusing in your sweet spot, all aim to improve movement and promote unimpeded flow. So let's assume you have embarked on the psychological work of looking at your self-limiting patterns, possibly with the help of a trained professional, and that you are ready to detach yourself from the old stories and patterns that may have helped to protect you psychologically as a child, but now hold you back. Such work can take years, but it need not. If you stick with it, over time, you will find that the old bad habits begin to loosen their hold. So let's assume you're ready to make some changes to help you achieve at your highest level. In the next several chapters, I'll show you how you can train yourself in the practical habits that will lead you toward flexible focus. While the details that create flexible focus vary from person to person, some elements must appear in every plan, just as some ingredients are common to, say, all good red sauces. Many Italian cooks would say that tomatoes in some form, olive oil, onions, garlic, and a choice of thyme, basil, or oregano are the five essential ingredients in a good red sauce. Some would add carrots, celery, and green peppers to the list, along with salt, pepper, and maybe sugar. Not me. But no cook would omit tomatoes, olive oil, and various seasonings. It's the same with flexible focus. There are five essential elements in my basic recipe. I developed my recipe in the test kitchen of my own life and in my clinic with thousands of clients and patients over the past 30-plus years. I savor the recipe because my moments of full attention, of flexible focus, are moments I enjoy even more than a fine wine or a sublime meal. In these moments, I make what amounts to mental music, and so do we all. If you think of consciousness as a violin, moments of flexible focus are when we play it the best. It is when the ideas and information are flowing against the least resistance. The basic plan includes the following five key elements, which I described in the introduction. You will always need these five ingredients. You will add your own favorite flavorings to this basic set, but if any one of the five is missing, the plan will fail. 1. Energy. You should monitor your brain's energy supply at least as carefully as you monitor your car's supply of gas or your bank account's supply of money. You'll be surprised at how much more focused you can be every day if you follow the six basic practices of wise energy management, my so-called Sensational Six. Sleep, nutrition, exercise, meditation, cognitive stimulation, and positive human contact. And how poorly focused you become when you neglect any of them. 2. Emotion. Passion drives achievement. If you want to achieve flexible focus, you need to learn how to regulate your emotional state. Emotion can be your greatest ally, but it can also hold you back more than your worst enemy. The secret is to work in an environment that is high on trust and low on fear. To work in a position that allows you to use your best talents and to know your hot buttons and emotional foibles and learn to manage them well. 3. Engagement. To perform at your best, you must get hooked or engaged. As Jim Lehrer, one of the world's authorities on peak performance, points out, engagement, like a turbocharge, drives us to achieve at our best. When you work in your sweet spot, the overlap of what you love to do and are really good at doing, and what advances the mission or what someone will pay you to do, you maximize your chances of getting hooked and fully engaged. 4. Structure. Structure, this simplest of words, has the most magnificent powers. It clears your way. It slashes through the underbrush. It allows you to focus rather than constantly being led off track. Structure refers to the world you create for yourself, the work world you build. It also refers to what you do, rather than what you let be done to you. Flexible focus depends upon structure, and structure depends upon planning and taking back the control you may have unwittingly given away. 5. Control. The entire 5-step plan depends upon your exercising what control you have, rather than allowing modern life to control you. People have varying levels of control, depending on their situations, but most people today have far more control than they use. In the chapters that follow, I will outline various elements of the plan in more detail. As you learn to work with yourself rather than against yourself, to work with your grain rather than against it, to create strategies that facilitate focus and peak performance, to learn remedies beyond the old standby of simply working harder, you will indeed find that the seemingly magical process yields to rational planning and produces extraordinary results. Chapter 8. Harnessing the Power of the Body. How many times have you found yourself sitting in a meeting, yawning, pinching yourself, grinding your teeth, or chewing your tongue in a painful effort to stay awake? Note, your tongue doesn't love this. How many days have you gone to the coffee machine multiple times, begging the caffeine to create some extra energy? Note, don't rely on caffeine. It can help, but it can't do the whole job. Most people wake up, maybe grab some breakfast, or at least a shot of caffeine, go to work, and assume they can stay consistently focused without doing any special preparation or taking any steps specifically designed to replenish and maintain their energy throughout the day. Such people are Exhibit A in poor mental energy management. If you are such a person, don't feel bad. After all, few people, and certainly few managers, teach anyone how to regulate mental energy. Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, Red Bull, Mountain Dew, Jolt, and the local drug dealer all love your ignorance. But your brain and the rest of your body don't. And when your brain is in a bad way, you perform poorly. Rule number one is this: never take energy for granted. You can't be alert if your energy is low, and you can't pay a nickel's worth of attention if you aren't alert. Low energy means low focus. High energy is a necessary, albeit insufficient, condition for high focus. You can get through the day, as most people do, without taking special care of your energy supply. But if you want to do better than just get through, then follow the simple steps I lay out in this and the chapters that follow. Over time, they will ensure optimal maintenance of energy for your brain. Every day in the newspaper, on the internet, or in the thousands of books about the brain now in print, you can read about ways to overhaul yourself by overhauling your brain. Some of these plans are sound, while others aim only to sell you a line of products. I've tested many of the products on myself, and if nothing else, they've given me the most expensive urine in the Boston area. You truly do not need most of what's for sale. Brain boosters have become the nutritional equivalent of cosmetics. People pay tons of money for the products, not because they are actually getting something of value, but because they want to believe they are. It's amazing how many of us disregard something as important and simple as personal energy management until we are practically somnolent, on the brink of conking out, or making serious, serial mistakes. But here is a simple, important fact. Your body knows things that your brain doesn't. Your body knows your energy state before your brain does. It's as if your body has a brain too. You can't be on top of your game, produce what you need to produce, focus, and learn if your body, of which your brain is obviously a part, isn't primed to do it. Over a century ago, William James posited that the mind follows the body's commands, not the other way around. More recently, social psychologist James Layard ran an experiment in which he attached electrodes to people's faces and directed some to smile, others to frown. Then he asked the people how they felt. The smilers felt happier, and the frowners felt angrier. In other words, what's going on biologically, in your body, goes a long way in determining how and what you feel and think. For something this important, managing your physical and mental energy is pretty simple, though doing so may require some changes of habit. There are two components of effective energy management. First, and by far most important, is preparation, or what I call prep work, making your entire self able to support you as you go about your day. Second is maintenance throughout the day, or what I call field work. Most people pay far more attention to field work, intervening in the moment of crisis or fatigue, than prep work, which would prevent the crisis and fatigue from occurring in the first place. The Sensational Six. Prep work relies on the Sensational Six. Do the things I recommend in this and succeeding chapters, and your body and brain will love you. Your brain will give you much more time in flexible focus if you prepare it every day by following each of these practices. As you read through the next two chapters, you might be tempted to say, "Yes, yes, I know all that already." And you may. But do you use what you know? The key now is for you to start practicing the Sensational Six in your daily life so that your body and brain can support you as you work and play. As I mentioned before, these are the practices: sleep, nutrition, exercise, meditation, stimulation, connection, positive human contact. We all need to follow the first three practices, sleep, nutrition, and exercise, in order to function and stay healthy. The second two, meditation, stimulation, boost psychological health as well as physical. We often overlook or avoid the last one, connection. It is my proprietary element, the one that I champion above all others, while most other experts ignore it or fail to recognize its extraordinary power. These six practices interweave and support each other. The greatest power lies in following all six. Sleep. Remember Jean, who illustrated the problem of multitasking? One reason her focus was chronically splintered had to do with her inability to get enough sleep. Try as she might, she never was able to create a schedule that allowed her to get the sleep her brain and body needed to function optimally. And remember Jack, who illustrated the problem of excessive worry? He dismissed sleep by saying, "I can sleep when I'm dead." He paid a far greater price than he realized for his cavalier attitude. Like Jean and Jack, millions of people operate on too little sleep, and they hurt themselves in big and small ways as a result. If you regularly get less than whatever your body needs, the levels of the appetite-increasing hormone, ghrelin, rise, while the levels of the appetite-suppressing hormone, leptin, decline. That's why lack of sleep can make you fat. Sleeplessness also contributes to high blood pressure, depressed immune function, and an increased risk of cancer and of catching colds and flu. It is also well known that lack of sleep leads to irritability, trouble concentrating, and lapses in memory. Lack of sleep turns highways into danger zones. Roughly 60% of adult drivers report having driven a vehicle while feeling drowsy in the space of a year, and more than a third say they have actually fallen asleep at the wheel, putting themselves, their passengers, and other drivers in serious jeopardy. As if that weren't enough, lack of sleep makes your face puffy and unattractive. Moreover, it's practically impossible to get into a state of flexible focus if you are sleep-deprived. In fact, in a sleep-deprived state, you're likely to develop ADHD-like symptoms. In an April 2013 New York Times article, Dr. Vatsal Thakkar described a patient who had all the classic symptoms of ADHD: procrastination, forgetfulness, a propensity to lose things, and, of course, the inability to pay attention consistently. Weirdly, the patient was 31 and had never had these symptoms before, something that went completely against the diagnostic criteria for ADHD. As it turned out, the patient had a chronic sleep deficit, not ADHD. After the doctor prescribed some techniques for getting to sleep at night, the patient's symptoms disappeared. One of the greatest favors you can do your brain and your entire body is to get enough sleep. Sleep is tonic. As Shakespeare observed, sleep knits up the raveled sleeve of care, the death of each day's life, sore labor's bath, balm of hurt minds, great nature's second course, chief nourisher in life's feast. Shakespeare knew that sleep is really good for you. I don't disagree, you may respond, but I just don't have time to get the sleep I should get. I have too much work to do, and if I'm going to see my family at all, the hours I'd otherwise spend sleeping are the only place where I can steal time for the work I have to get done. Reset your priorities to make time for sleep. Science has proven it's worth it. Sleep research has been booming of late, which, in a recent book, journalist David K. Randall engagingly summarizes. Today's researchers believe that they are in the golden age of their field. Sleep is now understood as a complex process that affects everything from the legal system to how babies are raised to how a soldier returning from war recovers from trauma. And it is also seen as a vital part of happiness. Whether you realize it or not, how you slept last night probably has a bigger impact on your life than what you decide to eat, how much money you make, or where you live. All of those things that add up to what you consider you, your creativity, emotions, health, and ability to quickly learn a new skill or devise a solution to a problem, can be seen as little more than byproducts of what happens inside your brain while your head is on a pillow each night. It is part of a world that all of us enter and yet barely understand. Sleep isn't a break from our lives. It's the missing third of the puzzle of what it means to be living. The amount of sleep you need varies from person to person. One way to tell how much you need is to notice how long you sleep without being awakened by an alarm clock or some other external means of waking you up. Assuming you don't drink alcohol before you go to bed, alcohol is a sleep disruptor, and you aren't overtired so that you are in catch-up mode, your body will tell you how much sleep you physiologically need by waking you up when you've reached that number of hours. Most adults need between 7 and 8 hours of sleep a night. A few of us need less, and some of us more. whatever you do, please don't think of sleep as wasted time, an indulgence, or a generous reservoir from which you can steal time for work. Do what your brain and body beg you to do. Get enough sleep. To do this, you will need to develop new habits if you don't get enough sleep now. In the short run, you will need discipline, but you will reap rewards quickly, which will solidify your motivation. As an immediate payoff, you will wake up refreshed and sharp, rather than needing to push the snooze button. You will feel what I call a morning burst, a surge of energy that can power some of your best work right at the start of the day. You can make the process easier by practicing what's called good sleep hygiene. Here are a few do's and don'ts. Do set a regular bedtime and get up time. Your brain gets used to this. Do make sure you have comfortable bedding. Do reserve your bed for sleep and sex, not for work. Do turn off the TV and take a warm bath or read a bit before sleep. Don't drink alcohol for 4 hours before sleep. Alcohol induces sleep at first, but then, as levels decline, it wakes you up during the night and interferes with valuable REM sleep. Don't eat heavy foods for 4 hours before sleep. Don't engage in heavy exercise before sleep. Don't toss and turn if you can't sleep. Instead, get up and go into another room and read for a little while. Most people sleep better if they don't share a bed. If you sleep poorly, you might consider sleeping alone or getting a king-size bed. If your partner snores, wakes up during the night, or tosses and turns, you won't get the sleep you need. A January 1991 study published in the Journal of Marital and Family Therapy found that spouses that had opposite sleep-wake patterns reported more difficulties in their relationship, including less frequent sex, less time talking, and more conflict overall. A nap in mid-afternoon, the typical time people feel sleepy, can provide a quick pick-me-up. Some enlightened companies actually set aside nap rooms that people can sign up for. If napping is not for you, consider meditation, which can be just as helpful as a nap. If sleep continues to be a problem, you might consider playing soothing music as you fall asleep. There is a free app called DreamPad that can download to your smartphone. I use it myself. It always puts my wife and me to sleep. And there are various natural sleep remedies like valerian root and melatonin, as well as over-the-counter sleep aids such as Benadryl or Tylenol PM. Finally, there are prescription sleep remedies like Ambien, Lunesta, and Trazodone. I strongly advise using the prescription aids only as a last resort. People reach for them too quickly and become dependent on them rather than practicing proper sleep hygiene and using natural aids. Consult with your doctor regarding ongoing sleep problems, as there are various medical and psychiatric problems that can interfere with sleep, including sleep apnea, depression, anxiety disorders, arthritis, cancer, heart failure, lung disease, gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, overactive thyroid, stroke, Parkinson's disease, and Alzheimer's disease, as well as medications or medical conditions that wake you up to urinate. Don't diagnose yourself. When you see your doctor, try to come away with better solutions than medication alone. Remember Mary, whose doctor gave her Prozac, saying simply, "At least it's something," when she needed much more help than just that? You should always have a multimodal approach to problems related not just to sleep, but to the mind-brain in general. Nutrition. As the people I profiled in Part 1 began to sink into trouble, most of them encountered problems with nutrition. Some people self-medicate with food as Jean did when they are stressed or anxious. Some people go in the other direction and starve themselves. Less substituted life in front of a screen for a healthy diet, and it cost him. Nutrition is a hot topic these days, and justifiably so. Last time I checked, there were 229,384 books related to food on Amazon.com. Diet books abound. The subject of nutrition has moved from a topic of marginal interest a few decades ago to the mainstream today. At your average social gathering, you will usually hear at least a few people talking about the cleansing regimen they just went on, or the supplement they're taking and swear by, or the surprisingly tasty vegan selections at the spa they just returned from. To avoid wasting money, at best, and putting one's life in danger, at worst, it's critical that the buyer be informed. No longer a minor fad, nutrition is a science whose time has come, and we need to take this science seriously. At one time, we didn't need to monitor so carefully what we ate, as well as what we breathed in, what we drank, what came into contact with our skin, and what hit us through invisible currents of radiation or other forms of energy from the sun, power lines, television screens, cell phones, and who knows what else. But that time is past. To achieve health today, we must monitor what gets into us by whatever route. It's said we are what we eat. Also include in that what we breathe, touch, absorb, or in any other way take in. While we can't control all the routes of access into ourselves, we can regulate what we eat and drink, as long as we take care to do so. When you don't eat right, your brain can't function well. Many people wake up in the morning, drink a cup or two of coffee, and eat a bagel or muffin, and call that breakfast. Or eat nothing at all. Then they eat a big sandwich and a bag of Doritos for lunch, down it with a sugar-packed soda, and wonder why they feel sleepy in the afternoon. This is about eating high glycemic food, to which I'll turn in a moment. Later, they go home and need a hamburger, have a beer or three, and relax in front of the television. Note the lack of fruits and vegetables. While the pounds pile on, the brain, depleted of the real nutrition it needs to function well, is starving. You simply can't focus when you're in a starch and sugar-induced haze. You have to eat, so why not eat as healthfully as you can so you can do your best work? It is beyond the scope of this audiobook to give detailed advice on what makes for the healthiest diet. However, I would like to stress a few basic points. Like getting enough sleep, eating the right food is not difficult to do, unless you live in poverty. If you are listening to this audiobook, you can probably afford to eat right. Like sleeping right, it is mostly a matter of learning what's best, then committing to doing it. Before focusing in on nutrition and the brain, let me first emphasize a few principles of sound nutrition in general and offer a few specific suggestions as well. Eat whole foods. Avoid packaged, processed, or preserved foods. With some exceptions, like canned tomatoes, the food that is best for you is fresh from the ground, the farm, or the sea. The China study, one of the most rigorous studies ever conducted on what makes for the healthiest diet, concluded that vegan was best. The scientists who conducted the study examined the eating habits in over 100 villages across China. While vegan was best, it was also clear that eating plenty of vegetables and whole foods in general correlated with good health. If you can't or don't want to do vegan, I can't and on most days don't want to, then come as close as you can. Absorb the nutrients you ingest. Many people begin the day with a cup of warm water and a squeeze of lemon to help their bodies digest food better. A middle-aged friend of mine also noticed a big difference when she began making her own fresh, blended juice. She bought a powerful juicer into which she tosses whole fruits, blueberries, apples, half a banana, half a lemon, vegetables, carrots, cucumber, spinach, ginger. She adds a tablespoon of spirulina, a tablespoon of protein powder, a packet of the natural sweetener stevia, water, and presses the whoosh button. "I drink it in the morning and snack on it through the day," she says. I eat a healthy salad for lunch and a small dinner. The week I began doing this, I noticed a gigantic jump in my energy, focus, and productivity. And I've lost weight, too. Keep red meat to a minimum. If you must eat red meat, consider buying organic and grass-fed beef, buffalo, or venison. Use fish, pork, chicken, beans, and other nutrient-rich vegetables as a source of nourishment instead. Don't scarf down a whole steak. Instead, broil one, cut off a quarter, and use it as a salad topping. Many would advise omitting not only beef, but pork, chicken, and even fish. I eat them, but it's your call. Consider going gluten-free. I went gluten-free myself and lost 20 pounds I needed to lose in 6 weeks, pounds that have stayed off. I feel more mentally alert than before as well. It may seem like a major change, but I found it not all that hard to go gluten-free. You just give up anything that contains wheat, malt, rye, and bulgur, which means you give up most bread, cake, cookies, crackers, pasta, beer, soy sauce, and various other foods. Consider eliminating dairy. Some experts urge removing all dairy, from milk to cheese to ice cream, from your diet. A nutritionist I know and respect has been trying to persuade me to eliminate dairy, but as yet, I haven't. You can be your own laboratory. Try it and see how you feel. Eat locally. Try to eat locally raised food free of hormones, antibiotics, pesticides, and other chemicals. If you've read the eye-opening book Fast Food Nation, or have seen the chilling, award-winning documentary Food Inc., you already know that you should avoid all food produced by mass marketers, all the well-known brands, and stick with sources of food you know well enough to trust. The hormones, preservatives, and other chemicals that what I call Big Pharma, with an F, the agricultural version of Big Pharma, with a PH, put into food can slowly poison us, and they can block the body's ability to absorb nutrients. It makes sense to eat only those foods you know do not contain harmful chemicals, additives, or contaminants. Research your food, where it comes from and what goes into it, wherever you shop. If you can, put in a few raised beds in your backyard and grow your own fresh veggies and fruits. If you can't, just buy food you know is good. Take the right supplements. According to the April 2012 issue of the Harvard Men's Health Watch, half the adult population takes at least one dietary supplement. Because supplements are not regulated by the FDA, they are far easier to market than medications. Often cheap to produce, they turn huge profits. In 2010, Americans spent $28 billion on supplements. Most of these purchases were rooted more in blind hope and persuasive, deceptive advertising than in scientific evidence. According to the same Harvard report, even multivitamins are not worth the money we spend on them. For adults, the Harvard report advises a daily supplement of vitamin D3, 1,000 international units, or IU, along with a daily supplement of calcium carbonate or calcium citrate, 1,000 milligrams for men, higher levels for women, as well as a daily supplement of 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids, DHA, and EPA. You should consult with your doctor before committing to any of these, but in most instances, your doctor will approve. If you carefully follow each of my suggestions for good nutrition, your body will be better able to absorb the nutrients it needs anyway, so you won't need supplements. Taking these steps is no longer just for tree huggers and fanatics. All of us ought to do it for our health in general and our mental acuity in particular. There is one other critical food you should monitor throughout the day to help your brain stay focused and alert. Glucose. glucose is the brain's chief source of energy. If glucose levels remain steady throughout the day, you stand the best chance of maintaining constant focus. Unfortunately, many people eat in such a way that their glucose levels yo-yo up and down. When you start your day with coffee and a muffin or a bagel, your pancreas secretes a bolus of insulin to handle the sugar, glucose, load. Your blood glucose level spikes, then plummets when the insulin hits its targets. As glucose levels plummet, you head to the coffee station for more caffeine and carbohydrates to get more energy, which induces the cycle to repeat over and over throughout the day. Ever wonder why there's a Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts on every block? And why they sell the combination of caffeine and foods packed with sugar? Because they are cashing in on this cycle. The caffeine and carbs dealers are the most dangerous purveyors of legal drugs on the planet, mostly because so few people are aware of the dangers. After lunch, especially a lunch high in starchy carbohydrates and low in protein, the same spike and trough in glucose ensues, leading to the well-known 3 p.m. blahs. You might think that you were just not an afternoon person, or you might wish you could live in a country where an afternoon siesta is the norm. Instead, you can avoid the mid-afternoon blahs simply by eating a lunch that has enough protein to help stabilize your glucose levels. If you do feel some blahs, simply do a brief burst of exercise, followed by eating an apple or a banana, or some of that leftover homemade juice, or take a quick nap. The general rule in connecting nutrition to brain function throughout the day is, do all you can to keep your glucose level from yo-yoing, eat a breakfast with protein, eat a balanced lunch, use a fruit snack and a burst of exercise to combat the blahs, eat more fresh fruits and vegetables to feed your brain the micronutrients it needs. Also, watch the amount of coffee you drink. Like Jack, who was a caffeine addict, billions of people around the world use caffeine every day. By any sensible reckoning, caffeine is a performance-enhancing drug. One study showed that women who drank 4 cups of coffee per day had a significantly lower risk of depression than those who did not. Used wisely, caffeine is an ally. A cup of coffee increases your ability to focus and think quickly. Just don't drink too much of it or rely on caffeine, rather than the other steps in the Sensational Six to maintain your mental energy. How much is too much? If you have undesirable side effects like elevated blood pressure, elevated heart rate, agitation and anxiety, upset stomach, headache, dizziness, or insomnia, that's too much. Caffeine is a diuretic, which means it will make you urinate more than usual, but that is an acceptable side effect within reasonable limits. It can also act as a laxative, which, again, is acceptable within limits. Be careful of abruptly discontinuing the use of caffeine. If you don't gradually taper it, you will get a severe headache. The takeaway on caffeine: some is good, too much is bad. I drink 2 or 3 cups of coffee a day. It is my favorite medication to help me focus. I rarely leave home without it. Exercise. The people profiled in Part 1 encountered their periods of greatest success when they were physically active. Think of Jack and how happy and successful he was in college when he was playing Division I hockey. Or think what a godsend the world of sport was for Sharon as she was growing up. That physical exercise enhances brain function is now well documented. For example, in 2011, a team of researchers at the University of Illinois conducted an experiment with 4 groups of mice. One group lived like little princelings. They got to eat nuts, fruits, and cheese, and lived in cages filled with colorful toys. Another group got the same treatment, but also had small running wheels in the cages. In the third group's cage, the poor mice got nothing but boring kibble and water and some bedding. The fourth group's cage was as sparse as the third's, but it included a running wheel. The researchers then put the mice through some cognitive tests and studied their brain tissues. It turned out that the toys and fancy food did not improve the mice's brain power. The only variable that made a significant difference was the running wheel. The mice that ran on the wheel had healthier brains and did better on cognitive tests than the mice that did not have access to the running wheel. If you need further convincing on the extraordinary power of exercise to revitalize your life, replenish your brain, and restore your zest, read the book Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain, by my close friend and colleague, John Rady, MD. In the book, Rady explains how exercise is truly the best defense against everything from mood disorders to ADHD, addiction, menopause, and Alzheimer's disease. He demonstrates how the brain works exactly like the body's muscles do. They grow stronger with use and atrophy with inactivity. The data underlying his research is conclusive. Exercise is beyond doubt one of the best tonics available for your brain. If we all got enough exercise, we could quickly and drastically reduce our use of medications, not only in psychiatry, but in medicine in general. I can hear you thinking, I get it. I should get on the treadmill. But that idea bores you to death. Mice actually like running wheels, but for most humans, including myself, even the thought of such exercise is an instant turnoff. It's no fun. It's time-consuming. You sweat and you stink, and even when you do it, you have little to show for it, compared to all those fabulously fit runners and lifters. You've finally given up on ever becoming one of them, one of those supreme achievers who has a perfect body and is training for the Ironman triathlon in Hawaii. What to do? The secret is, make it fun. Start by walking every day with a friend. Find someone else who wants to make exercise a regular part of his or her life, and schedule a morning walk or an evening stroll. If one of you has a dog, all the better. If it's winter, just dress warmly. Another way to incorporate exercise into your life is by reserving time for a game of some sort. I've been playing squash on Tuesday afternoons with my best friend for 32 years. It's a great way to both get exercise and also keep up with a friend, which is really good for your brain too. A third way, which is more expensive than the previous two, both of which are free, is to work with a trainer. The great thing about a trainer is that since you are paying him or her, you tend to show up, while the trainer sees to it that you don't slack off. In 2003, I had a total hip replacement. All those years of playing squash caught up with me. After I went through the weeks of rehab, I started working out with a Russian trainer named Simon Zaltzman, who has changed my life. Zaltzman is in his 60s and built like the proverbial brick outhouse. He is both a world-class mathematician and a world-class athlete. Ever since he came to the United States, he's worked as a trainer. What is so special about Zaltzman is that he is smart and has such a wry, low-key sense of humor that, as tired as I get during the workouts, I am never bored. For example, in our very first workout, he had me do some weightlifting. At one point, I groaned in protest. Oh, God! In his rich Russian accent, Zaltzman mordantly replied, God cannot help you now. Even though I am lazy and hate exercise for the sake of exercise, I look forward to going to my sessions with Zaltzman. I know he will keep me amused, even as I endure what he likes to call good torture. And the sessions have stood me in good stead, for in 2013, I had my other hip replaced. I rebounded much faster than the operation in 2013 than the one in 2003, thanks to my work with Zaltzman. One last point. Remember, sex counts as exercise. Sex raises your heartbeat and metabolism. It floods your brain with oxygen and your body with all kinds of beneficial hormones. Orgasms are good for you. Best of all, sex is fun. So enjoy as much sex as you can, with a consenting partner, of course. Sex is one of the few things in life that is good for you, you're born with the ability to do, is free, and is fun. Chapter 9. Harnessing the Power of the Mind.